You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about a large-scale street art installation that's going to cover two blocks of Milwaukee with murals.
First, there's been a growing push to take a more humanistic approach in social service and correctional institutions. The approach means looking at trauma and past history in particular to understand how to treat mental health and address criminal justice problems.
A lot of research has shown that certain negative childhood experiences can lead to longer-term problems well into adulthood, and Wisconsin's been part of a nationwide move toward trauma-informed care. That term also made into the headlines alongside scandal at the Lincoln Hills Juvenile Correctional Center, which blamed the newer approach for security and disciplinary breaches.
Dee Hall joins us now. She's the managing editor and co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Her report on trauma-informed care was published yesterday, and it's posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Dee, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You start your piece telling the story of a woman named Tamara Oman and how trauma-informed care changed her life. Can you tell us a little bit about her story?
Yeah, Tamara is a very open and actually quite a funny and delightful woman whom I ran across because she's become a spokesperson for trauma-informed care in this state. And she had a very rough childhood. There was physical abuse. There was sexual abuse turned into some substance abuse on her part. She ended up committing crimes and she ended up in prison. But she was able to sort of identify and deal with the trauma that she had suffered as a child, which she believes was sort of the source of a lot of her problems, and that a lot of what she was doing to herself, a lot of the sabotaging of her success, was due to these early childhood experiences.
Let's get a handle on the definitions here. Trauma-informed care, what is that and how does it differ from other approaches that we might take?
I think one way it's been described to me, it puts the human back in human services. So it is an approach. It's not really a program exactly, but it's more of an approach of understanding that a lot of people have suffered a lot of things in their lives and being sensitive to that and trying to avoid triggering them, making them feel bad, or somehow reliving the incident or incidents. And also just understanding that these kind of early experiences can have a lot of effects. In children, for example, it can affect their learning and how well they're able to pay attention in school or whether they're able to accomplish certain tasks in a certain way. So it's more of an approach. And so I looked at it across the state of Wisconsin in a bunch of different ways.
Well, Wisconsin in particular, it sounds like, has embraced trauma-based care. Where have you seen it being used and how is it working?
So I visited the courtroom of a Milwaukee County Circuit judge. Her name's Judge Mary Trigiano, and she uses trauma-informed care in her courtroom. She wants to know the life stories of all the people who are before her in the adult. It's a drug treatment court for people who've lost custody of their children. And so they work very closely with these individuals, not just trying to say, okay, you have to pass these drug tests and you have to go to these meetings, but talking to them about their trauma and trying to overcome their trauma and move forward in a successful way.
What do we know about how well it works, how effective it is at helping people maybe not end up in the criminal justice system, hold down jobs, stay in housing, that kind of thing?
It's a little tough to know because since it's an approach and not a specific 1-2-3 program. So it's mostly anecdotal evidence. For example, Judge Trigiano, I asked her, you know, are you guys measuring this in any way? She said, we're not exactly measuring it, but we just know that for some people, for many people, it works really, really well. And the reason I started to get into this is I was noticing trauma-informed care being invoked as an approach on a whole variety of sectors in Wisconsin, starting from First Lady Tonette Walker on down, and I just wanted to examine, well, who's using it and how are they using it and is it working?
So in terms of who actually conducts this sort of care, healing of the past, these childhood traumas, is it something that takes place between a counselor and their client, I guess, over the long term?
It can, but it can also be in everyday interactions that people have with other people. For example, I went up to Waupaca County, and they have tried to transform their Department of Health and Human Services into a completely trauma-informed agency. And so it shows itself in ways such as the people who are manning the call centers where people call in and they're having problems getting their benefits, you know, rather than just, you know, saying, you know, check, you know, you did this wrong, sorry, you can't get your benefits. It becomes more of a, okay, I understand you're probably frustrated, I understand you've gone through a lot, let's figure out a way together. To solve your problem. And so it is more of a building relationships, even with, in their case, even with parents who've been accused of child abuse and neglect, which I find kind of hard. But they said that their reunification rates have skyrocketed since they started this approach of more working with parents, even when the parents were accused of child maltreatment.
We're talking with Dee Hall right now from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about trauma-informed care and how it's working in Wisconsin. And Dee, let's get to a little bit of the criticism of trauma-informed care. Now, some officials at the Lincoln Hills Correctional Facility, which has been plagued with all manner of charges in the last year or so, have said that perhaps some of what went wrong there was put down to trauma-informed care. What do you say, and what did you find out about that?
Well, there's a union official whom I interviewed up there, and he says he's in daily contact with the workers at Lincoln Hills, and it is the assessment of not everyone up there, but many of the frontline workers, that this new approach, which is more empathetic, it's less punitive, has resulted in a breakdown in security and discipline at the facility, which has made it more dangerous for staff and more dangerous for other juvenile inmates there. The folks higher up the food chain disagree. They say this is the standard of care in our state. It's becoming the standard of care everywhere, and that the problems at Lincoln Hills are not related to their use starting in about 2014 or so of trauma-informed care.
You also interviewed some academics looking at childhood trauma, and they're given something called an ACE score, it sounds like. And it sounds like there's a big correlation between how high that score is and future outcomes. What do you know about that?
Right. So this was developed several years ago. It's called the Adverse Childhood Experience. It's a quiz, and it's up to 10 yes or no questions. And it involves things that may have happened to you when you were a child, and they range anything from being physically or sexually abused to having a person who, a parent who's in prison. So what you do is, you know, depending on how big your ACE score is, your chances of having some adverse outcomes yourself, like being unemployed, being incarcerated, having a substance abuse problem, are very tightly correlated with these bad things that happened to you when you were a kid. And so that's sort of the theory behind it, is if you can understand what all of your adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs as they call them, are, you might have a better chance of figuring out, oh, that's why I do that, or, oh, okay, that's why I think about things this way. And then some people are able to address their problems knowing those things.
And the statistics are actually a little staggering on this. There's a surprisingly large amount of people who can look back and say they have had one of these childhood trauma experiences, more than you might think.
Yeah, it's almost 60% in Wisconsin for the surveys that have been done. Now, that can be anywhere from a single incident, which a child is able to overcome very well because they have supportive family around them and they have other resiliency factors. But it can really derail people as well, too.
What kind of training hubs are there in Wisconsin? If someone's listening right now, say, and they want to try to administer this, where would they go?
Well, there's the National Traumatic Stress Network, I believe it's called, which is sort of a national clearinghouse. And you will also see, if you are in certain schools in Wisconsin, they're starting to roll this out as an approach with their students. We're also seeing it in some of the social services, like foster families, caregivers are starting to be trained in this approach as well.
It's interesting reading the piece. You get the sense that, at least among a segment of the population, they have been living with this wound for decades of their life, and they were almost just waiting for someone to say, what happened?
Right. That's exactly what, you know, that's sort of the classic approach. It's instead of, you know, what did you do? The first question in trauma-informed care is, what happened to you? And the idea is that when you're ready to tell your story, you're able to sort of unload a bunch of the stuff that's probably been derailing you in your life. So there was a woman who gave a very, very shocking, I guess I would say, but very moving talk at a convention last fall of juvenile and child welfare officials in Wisconsin. And she overcame the kind of trauma that you can't even imagine. 19 years on the street, homeless, crack addict, multiple children taken away from her at birth. It was just a terrible, terrible situation. But to see her now, she is successful. She has homes. She has a daughter who is thriving in school. And it was that question, what happened to you, that she says led to her eventual recovery.
Dee, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot.
That was Dee Hall. She's a co-founder and managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And she recently covered the use of trauma-focused care in Wisconsin social service institutions. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new art project is bringing together artists from around the country, even the world, to create murals along Milwaukee streets. We'll hear more in just a few minutes.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Writing on the body is as old as time. Artists learn how to do it in multiple ways, including apprenticeships. Gabe Joyner is a second-year apprentice at a tattoo shop in Madison. She tells us about her new vocation.
I decided I wanted to when I was like 16. I had a friend that was like 19 that was doing it, and I was like, oh, I want to do that so bad. And I've always drawn, and I've done comics, and I used to draw like Sharpie like barbed wire armbands around people in high school and stuff because I was cool in like the late 90s. So I just like was always enthralled by it and thought it was like just beautiful and it's permanent. And I think I was just like hanging out with people that were like, that's so impractical, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you're probably right. And I like science, so I'm going to go to school for that, you know? And then later, I was, like, working at this job for 9 years in an office. And I was, like, going, you know how you get those, like, you go on, like, a weird rabbit hole on YouTube? And it was, like, watching, like, people on security cameras in offices, like, losing their minds. this is going to happen to me. Like, I get it, you know? And then I was, like, I'm just going to, like, kind of drop it and just do what I want because, like, why not? Why am I not doing stuff I want to do? Pretty much just bothering people. You know, I have a lot of friends that were tattoo artists and stuff, so they were, like, trying to help. And because nobody wants to apprentice anybody because it's a lot of work. It's different for everybody, but my experience is, it's like some places make you pay. Some places don't make you pay, which is my experience. But I'm, like, indebted to them for a certain amount of time. So I clean everything. I do their tubes. I answer the phones. I pick up kids sometimes. Go grocery shopping sometimes. You know, all that awesome stuff. But, like, they're giving me a career, you know? So it's, like, worth it, you know? I don't feel like women being in the tattoo industry is like a huge thing until, I mean, there's some, but it seems like lately there's like a lot more, which is pretty cool. My best friend Alice, she made me promise it'd be her first, she would be my first, and it was on Halloween, and one of my bosses wanted us to do it on Halloween because then we would remember the date because he doesn't really remember his first. So it was like this little, like, traditional skull with like a couple flowers over it, and it took me like, it's tiny, like, it took me like 4 hours. And she was like, oh my God, can you just be done? And we didn't even finish it. But, you know, they were hanging over me, telling me what to do and, like, all that fun stuff. And then, like, a couple months later, I got more practice, and then she came in and I finished it, and it was, like, 2 seconds, you know? So it was, like, amazing. I can't even, like, I can still, like, my stomach still is, like, you know, thinking about it. It was great. It was the best. I just want to be good. I like this job a lot in the sense, like, I love to learn. And this is the kind of job where you're just, like, never done, ever, you know? So it's like I always have something to look forward to or, like, learn or do or, you know what I mean? It's going to be changing. And so it's kind of perfect for me. I think that's good to, like, always be pushing yourself, you know, to be better.
Gabe Joyner is a tattoo apprentice in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org or find Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
From art on the human body, we move now to art on the sides of buildings. Black Cat Mural Alley is a large-scale art installation that's set to cover 2 blocks of Milwaukee's East Side with painted murals.
Joining us now to tell us more about the project is Stacey Williams-Ung. She's Program Director for Black Cat Mural Alley. Stacey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us the basics. What is happening here? Two blocks worth of murals.
Yeah, and they're all inside of an alley, and there aren't actually that many alleys in Milwaukee architecturally, so it's kind of a cool space. We were inspired by the space itself, and more than once I've heard that we weren't the first. I've already run into one guy who said, oh, yeah, I used to get run out of there by the police in the 80s. So it's not a new idea. A lot of people have wanted to put art in this alley for a long time. I guess it's just got good bones.
So how did your idea come about and actually get green-lighted?
Well, it depends on how you define green-lighted. We really are have just presented the vision to the community and said, let's do it, and more people are rallying behind us, and so now it seems to be happening. But there wasn't really an official day where we could say it was green-lighted. But Alderman Nick Kovac is behind us, the Milwaukee Arts Board is behind us, and everyone just seems to smile from ear to ear when we talk about it, so we haven't really encountered any pushback. It's been wonderful.
Tell us about the artists who are going to be involved.
Sure. Well, we got a lot of applications. We actually opened it up to a call for artists, really globally. And in addition to that, we went online and we went in magazines and so forth and said, who would we like to see in the alley? And we were looking at artists that we had seen featured in Juxtapose magazine and New York Times magazine, you know, anything. And just sort of, this is our wish list. And we wrote to about four of them, and all four of them wrote back and said, when can I start? So we're like, oh, wow, oh, that was easy. So we did not do a call for artists for the international artists. We could only afford one, so we're just going to have one artist come as kind of our headliner. His graffiti name is MTO. And he is a Frenchman, and he lives in Paris currently. He's lived in Berlin for many years and has done some of the most notable murals in Western Europe. So we're really proud to have him. So he's going to be coming to paint the south wall of the Oriental Theater in July.
What is his style like? What can we expect?
Figurative, very realistic. It's almost always people. And they're done in black and white, and there's usually a hint of color. So it might be, you know, just a man that appears to be sitting on the side of a building, but maybe his hat or his shoes or something are in color. There's usually a little splash of color. But they're usually monumental in size. I've seen work of his in person in Florida. He's painted in both Miami and Sarasota, and often they're 5, 6, 7 stories tall. We don't actually have that much space in Milwaukee, so it's going to be a little smaller in Milwaukee, but by our standards, it's going to be huge.
Talking to Stacey Williams-Ung, she's Program Director of Black Cat Mural Alley in Milwaukee. This is a project bringing artists from around the area, the country, and one from around the planet, turning an alley into an art installation, in effect. And there are some local artists, too. Is that right, Stacey?
That's right. We're going to have 8 local artists, 6 of whom are professionals and 2 are students. The 2 students, just as luck would have it, one from UWM and one from MIAD. We didn't do that on purpose, but we thought that was nice and fair. But Ian McGibbon is a UWM painting student, and Renee Martinez is a printmaking major at MIAD. So they're going to be our 2 students. We have 6 professional artists, including Tia Richardson, who's already done quite a number of murals around town, John Kowalczyk, also a prominent muralist around town, some first-timers who just had really great submissions, but who are working artists, Andrea Gazzetta, Brandon Minga, and Jenny Jo Cristan.
So with all of those people involved, how is this all going to fit together? Will it be cohesive, or is it meant to be sort of chunky in its presentation, different splashes of art?
Oh, we're not going to try and make it elegant and all fancy and knitted together at all. No, it's really meant to be an expression of each artist, and we trust each of them to use their own voice to put their own work of art on the alley. It's not going to be one big mural that everyone collaborates on. It's going to be each individual artist is going to do a piece, and they're going to be recognized for their piece, just like if you went into an art gallery and saw a group show.
So what's the overall goal here, just to bring a little magic into the city landscape?
Yeah, I might have to quote you on that. I like that. We're going to bring a little magic into the city landscape. Absolutely. I mean, street art is a pretty major art movement that's going on right now. I even heard someone say, you know, this is bigger than the Renaissance was in Western Europe. And I really don't think that's an overstatement if you look in terms of sheer volume. Anybody who's got an Instagram account or a Twitter account probably sees photos of street art on the daily, and depending on who you follow, you know, every 30 seconds. So it's just something that, you know, more and more as I present this to people from all walks of life, I'll present this to artist friends, but I'll present it to friends who are doctors and lawyers and a little bit more conservative, and they'll say, oh, yeah, when I was in Barcelona, I saw the most marvelous street art. So I feel like people from all walks of life are lighting up and getting excited about this and making it a part of their travels. People go on mural tours when they go to San Francisco or Barcelona or Miami or Brooklyn. And maybe if we play our cards right, we could do that in Milwaukee as well and Madison.
And Stacey, just briefly, when do you expect this to be all up and accessible for people to go take a look at it?
Well, we decided not to do it slowly. We decided to have it all installed at once. So I mentioned before that MTO is coming in July. He's the exception, and that's sort of to draw attention to the project. But everyone else, the other 10 artists, are going to be painting in September. So we're actually going to have a festival the weekend of the 17th and 18th and invite the public to come out, drink beer, you know, listen to music, and watch all these artists putting their murals in live.
Sounds fun. Well, Stacey, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
That was Stacey Williams-Ung. She's Program Director of Black Cat Mural Alley. And we've been talking about a large-scale art installation that will cover two blocks of Milwaukee with murals.
Coming up, we'll hear about a local leader's call to reduce violence in the Madison area after a string of shootings. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 7, it's today's edition of Reveal. Reveal combines the power and artistry of the driveway moment and storytelling with data-rich reporting on critically important issues. That's Reveal coming up tonight at 7.
First, a recent spate of related shootings in the Madison area has residents concerned and local leaders questioning what can be done to reduce what appears to be an increase in violence.
One community leader recently outlined not one or two, but 15 steps he believes could not only help reduce violence, but also stop it before it starts.
We're joined now by Michael Johnson. He's the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. He wrote a 15-step approach in Madison 365. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, you all.
Well, let's start with the way this violence looks. I mean, do you think there is a perception in Madison that, you know, this is Madison, violence doesn't happen here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, I would say over the last 10 years, you know, violence overall in Madison has actually decreased. And I think what's concerning to me and other leaders in this community is that when you look at some of the systemic issues that we're facing, you know, disparities in education, mass incarceration, those issues can have an impact on our city. And so when you look at these recent incidents that have occurred, we feel very strongly that we have to begin to work with the police department and come up with some innovative strategies to ensure that we keep Madison a safe city, because if we don't, what's going to happen? We're going to lose kids to other communities. Our schools are going to suffer because of it. We could potentially lose businesses, which will, you know, hurt our tax base. If our tax base is hurt because people don't feel safe, you know, in our city, public safety and other programs will be at jeopardy.
So there's a lot at stake, as you outline there. And it seems as though one of the things you're trying to do with this plan is you're calling for a coordinated approach. You want all hands on deck, everybody involved. What would be different about that compared with what you see so far?
Yeah, I see our proposal as common sense solutions. And it's not a us against them. This is a 15-point approach that came from leaders from the faith community, from nonprofits to African-American leaders, to parents of the kids that I serve at the Boys and Girls Club. So we believe that if we work in collaboration with the police department and look at programs and strategies that have been effective in other cities, that we can mitigate, you know, these risks. And I just know in the 6 years I've been here, I have had to help bury some of these young men and look their kids in the face and figure out how to provide, you know, support to those families. And recently, you know, one of the families we just helped had this young man had four daughters. And when you see the trauma that these kids go through, when you have a parent who is struggling to bury, you know, her son, I believe we have to reach these young people early and let them know that there's opportunities in our city, opportunities in our state, in our country, and we just have to we have to create those opportunities for them. So when I think about, you know, our plan, you know, in some cases, you know, you have to look at a variety of different things. And so point three in our plan talks about, you know, offering a $10,000 reward for information that would lead to the arrest and the conviction in any homicide case. You know, the reason we put that there is a lot of times in these situations, people don't feel safe talking to law enforcement officials. And if we can partner with, you know, a local foundation that can, you know, help ease the burden for someone feeling safe and knowing that they may have a financial benefit to reporting a crime in our community, you know, why not, you know, put that in place? And we can't allow people to hold our communities hostage, but at the same time, I understand why people are fearful in terms of coming forward.
Right, and you also mentioned protecting those people who do come forward and making sure there's a fund to do that.
Yeah, you know, just from somebody, you know, I had a phone call recently where, you know, a young mother was fearful for her life. And, you know, I had a conversation, this is a few months ago, and I had a conversation with Chief Covo, you know, about it. And I don't know if they necessarily have all of the resources available to them, you know, to protect those families that do come forward. You got to realize if you're living in a neighborhood that's infested with gangs and drugs and in some cases, you know, prostitution, and you have to live and work in that neighborhood, the minute you report a crime, the stakes are high, and there could be retaliation. And I think we have to give people confidence that if somebody do go forward and they do need protection, that that support is there. And right now, from what I'm hearing from people in the community, they don't feel that the police department has adequate resources to be able to provide some of that protection.
And Michael, I want to pick up on something you said a couple minutes ago. You said you want to make sure that young people know that there are opportunities out there for them. What parts of your plan address that aspect of this?
Yeah, so when I think about I was seeing 15, right? We talk about teaching children and their parents about conflict resolution strategies from a very early age. You know, when we made our announcement a couple of weeks ago, we did a skit and we brought in actors to show young people, here's how you deal with conflict in a positive way, but here's the ramifications when you deal with conflict in a negative way. When you shoot and kill someone, two lives are impacted by it, the victim and also the shooter. Because if you shoot and kill somebody, you're probably going to go to jail for a very, very long time. And then the person who is the victim loses his or her life. And so it's a lose-lose, you know, situation. The opportunity I see in that I believe in our city, we're a large enough city but a small enough city that we can address these issues. This ain't Milwaukee and this ain't Chicago. There's about 6,000 low-income kids in Dane County. There's 5,400 businesses in our county. Why can't we secure a paid summer internship for a lot of these young people during the summer months to keep them busy, to keep them occupied? You know, you want to keep guns off the streets of these kids. Give them a job. Let them earn, you know, a decent living. And that's what we got to do. We have to provide some hope. We got to provide some aspiration, and we got to provide, you know, opportunities for these young people. I had a young man that sent me a note the other day, and I want to read this to you. And he was critical of the plan, but I'm actually glad he sent me this message. He says, some of us have more guns than opportunities, Mr. Johnson. Some of my friends read your plan, and it's mostly all good, sir. However, the gun back program is a joke. We ain't turning in our guns for a $100 gift certificate to Target. That's for sure. We laughed when we heard this from my older sister. I know a lot of my friends are running around with burners, which is a gun. Sometimes I want to say something, but some of my friends are impulsive. And with almost all of us not having jobs, lots of time on our hands, things can get crazy. However, he goes on to say, please don't give up on us. Some of us are dealing with the cards we are dealt, and we are trying to survive in our environment. So you think about racial disparities and employment. Almost 25% of African Americans in this community are unemployed, 16% Latino. So if we don't begin to ensure that these kids graduate from high school, be prepared for college and careers, you and I as taxpayers will pay, because these young people will grow up and become dependent on public resources. Research shows that if a young person graduates from high school, you and I would save $200,000 over that young person's lifetime. So why not make that investment right now? Why not expose these young people to opportunities? Because if we don't, the streets will become their employer of choice, because they lose hope. And when these young people lose hope and they can't find work and they're trying to make a living, the things that we are experiencing as a city will not go away magically unless we begin to address some of these systemic issues that we're seeing.
And Michael, just briefly, because I want to get some calls in on this, but I want to talk a little bit in the same vein about your first call, which is that leaders, you call them leaders associated with incidents, I assume you're talking about these maybe violent incidents, should be offered gainful employment and training opportunities to help them become productive adults. And if not, you say you can offer them a ticket out of town or more police scrutiny. But that first one, offering people involved a job, is that something you think that could be hard to sell, maybe to law enforcement and other people?
Yeah, I think it depends on what it is. And so 70% of people who are incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. If it's somebody who has taken somebody's life, somebody who has caused harm to young people, I have no sympathy for those folks. But if there's somebody who's incarcerated for a nonviolent crime, I know people who work in this community now who are productive adults. I think about people like, you know, Raphael Ragland, who's a local movie producer. I think about Anthony Cooper, who runs the Nehemiah organization for Pastor G. There are men who have gotten in trouble 10, 15 years ago. And we all make mistakes, and I think that with the proper intervention and the support, I would prefer to have these ex-gang members living a productive lifestyle than to give up on them and create this new generation of kids getting involved in gangs and drugs.
Michael Johnson is with us right now. He's CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and he recently published 15 steps that he believes the Madison community could take to reduce violence in the city.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. A focus on Madison here, but these are not issues unique to Madison. We want to hear from you. What could be done? What is being done to reduce violence, to reduce crime in your community, to provide opportunity for younger people, especially younger people from lower income communities? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about violence and how to prevent it. So looking at Madison, recent shootings here, a string of them, community wondering how to prevent it, how to solve these problems. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. You may be facing this issue in your community, whether you're in Madison or Milwaukee or elsewhere. What would you like to see implemented to reduce violence? Did you have a violent past? Were you violent as a youth yourself? How did things work out for you? What made a difference, hopefully, in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Michael Johnson is with us. He's CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and he recently outlined 15 steps that he says can help reduce violence. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Whitney on the line in Verona. Whitney, hi.
Hi. I am a teacher who focuses on working with students and improving their employability skills. And I really just wanted to second what Mr. Johnson was saying about providing more employment opportunities for our youth. One of the challenges that I have faced is trying to get employers to hire students who maybe have a different skill set or have a criminal record. So my question is, what does Mr. Johnson see as getting our community to buy into hiring more of our youth in this community?
Great question. Thank you for that, yeah. Michael.
Yeah, that's a great question, and we're actually doing it right now. So we received a capacity building grant from the Rennebaum Foundation, and we have encouraged. So this summer, we're putting 275 kids to work at 32 different companies, from UW Health to Sarah Cycling to Fiskars, teaching kids about the employment opportunities that exist here. We have companies like CUNA Mutual who are paying our kids over $17 an hour to get experience in their finance department. And so, one, I think you have to have somebody that can focus. So just like you have salespeople that may be selling a product, we have to have salespeople that can go out and present these opportunities for employers and to talk about what the benefits are as it relates to hiring young people from this community. So we have begun to do that. We also encourage the mayor and also the county executive. Last few years, you've heard the mayor talk about his internship program. We helped him, you know, kickstart that. We've done the same thing for the county executive. So I think if the infrastructure is built city by city, if every city in Dane County hire a somebody who focuses on that, there's no reason why we can't put all 6,000 of those low-income kids to work in the city. I think it's very, very doable. But you also have to have somebody that can match these kids appropriately and to remove barriers that may exist for young people who need these kinds of opportunities.
So, Michael, do you see some sort of community liaison working between the kids and matching them with these businesses?
Yeah, so absolutely. So I think it could be done through a local nonprofit organization. It might be done with a career officer, you know, at a school. And so I think it's more than like these kids finding jobs, but how do we introduce them to career pathways? And so I would love to see a career pathway officer in every city, whether it's through a nonprofit or at a public school, and then there's a coordinated effort throughout Dane County to help place these young people into employment opportunities. And even if it's the reason I'm pushing internships first, you have to start somewhere. And to me, these young people, first jobs need to be getting through school. But what concerns me during the summer when it gets hot, that's when you see a lot of violence occur, a lot of shootings, and when kids are out of school between the hours of 3 to 5 p.m. So keeping them engaged after school, but in particularly during the summer when they have idle time on their hands, that's what's really concerning for me. And I think our community has the capacity and I believe have the will to be able to do something like this.
And Michael, just briefly before we go to our next caller who's waiting to talk to you, you want community centers to stay open late for that purpose, and we want funding for them.
Yeah, so I think we have a great asset in all of our community centers. I would love to see, as part of this 15-point plan, that our community centers are open on Saturdays and Sundays, that we're running, that we're open until 10 o'clock at night. But I believe most community centers would love to do it. The resources are not there to be able to do it because it's additional utility costs, additional manpower costs. But I think it's worth the investment to keep kids engaged and active until late at night. You know, for some teenagers, most kids are not going to bed until, you know, 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And so if we can keep kids off the streets and provide community centers with the appropriate, you know, transportation and navigate kids from community centers to their homes, I think we'll also continue to see our crime decrease like it has done over the years.
We're talking
but
to
if
Michael.
If we don't, our demographics are changing, and you'll see our numbers change.
Michael Johnson's with us, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, talking about his suggestions for reducing violence. And a quick call here from Ryan in Waukesha. Ryan, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Just a quick thought on the connection, of course, the community with the schools, but regarding and focusing on the schools primarily, connecting students to something they're passionate about, and secondly, connecting them to a mentor that they can feel very comfortable with and identify with, are the two criteria that I think we need to do more in schools. And I know that the Madison schools right now are investigating and making some progress on creating career academies in their high schools.
Ryan, thanks a lot for that. And Michael, in our last few moments here, what do you think about that, connecting youth to passion and finding them a mentor?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do at Boys and Girls Club. We run the largest public-private partnership in both the Madison and Verona School District, and a component of our AvidTops program is to connect our kids to mentors. And as a result, you probably heard about our college signing day where we had all 124 of our kids graduated from college and announced at a press event that they were going to college. We secured over $1 million for these kids. They're going to 31 different colleges and universities, and we believe because of the support we put in place to support these young people with mentors that they're going to go on and do great things. And so he is spot on.
Michael,
the fact that you got organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters who do great work, they need mentors to step up. There's a waiting list.
And we got to leave it there, Michael. I really appreciate your time today. That was Michael Johnson, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and he joined us there to talk about steps that he believes can help reduce violence.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.